This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Capitalism has been proclaimed dead more than once. It has also been called the greatest force for economic good the world has ever known. Despite the current economic downturn, the truth must be somewhere in between. Perhaps what this economy needs is a new kind of capitalism, one modeled after that practiced by Trappist monks. That got your attention, didn't it? Well, that isn't my idea. It's August Tarax, and he came up with it after observing the monks at work in their abbey in Mepkin, South Carolina, near Charleston. It's in Monk's Corner, actually. Mr. Tarax is not a wild dreamer. He's a former executive at both MTV and A&E, and he served as CEO of two Raleigh-based tech firms, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
A lot of what you're talking about today can be found on your website at augusttarak.com. That's August as in the month and T-U-R-A-K.com. Like spelling out website. you started your Raleigh-based tech firm, I think, if I recall correctly, with about $2,000.
Yeah, that's about it.
And then you sold it to a company that ended up selling it again for $150 million.
Yes, indeed.
That's a pretty good return on investment, it seems to me. And, yeah. And you say that... this is proof that the concept of conscious capitalism works.
Exactly.
So define conscious capitalism.
Well, you know, I want to go back to what you were talking about, you know, and look at the big picture. If you look at the 20th century, we tried nationalism and fascism and Nazism and socialism and communism, all those darn isms. Mm-hmm. Some of them were absolutely disastrous. Others were just mediocre. And then with the Reagan Revolution, we were thinking about, you know, this was the final victory of capitalism, and now we're where we are today. And I think the biggest, the big picture of the malaise that's afflicting the economy today is really the feeling that we've run out of ideas.
Really?
Where do we go from here?
Is it where do we go from here, or how do we get out of this hole?
Well, how do we get out of here, which means we have to have a plan, we have to have an idea of where we're going to go. But I think there's a depressing sense that we've tried everything and nothing seems to work. So to me, I like to differentiate what I call conscious capitalism, what I mean by transcending capitalism from ethical capitalism. It might be an artificial distinction in my own head, but I think in terms of ethical capitalism, the kind of things that we're doing right now are restraint. I think of it as a restraint, that we have to face the fact that we're not good people and we're going to do bad things, so we have to grit our teeth and make sure that we don't do these things by teaching our kids with a stick that they better be ethical. To me, conscious capitalism means what the monks understand, which is a fundamental truth. It is in our own self-interest to forget our self-interest. That the more we forget our self-interest, the more successful we are. And you can illustrate this very, very simply with some analogies from business. I come up in sales and marketing, for example. When I talk to salespeople and I do trainings with salespeople and things like that and consulting, and I tell them, the more you forget completely about your own product, completely about your commission plan, completely about your goal for this month, and concentrate on what the customer needs and wants, the more sales you're going to make, which means the more commission, which means it's going to be easier to hit your goal.
Hmm. You tell a story, and I don't know where I read this, but you tell a story about being hired to help turn around the sales division of a company mm-hmm. that had been tanking, and everybody in the other departments of the company hated the sales
right.
department. Hated them, which is not unusual.
Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. You're talking to a salesman here. We're nice guys.
So you went in, knew that you were in over your head, shut the office door, and began to think, now what can I do? And you went in your head to the monks.
Exactly.
And what did you do at that company?
Well, actually, you know, this what you're talking about was written in an article that I wrote for Forbes magazine on Forbes.com called Business Secrets of the Trappist. And what actually the infighting wasn't just against sales, it was everybody against everybody.
Okay.
And the company was in really, really bad shape, and I was brought in. So I sat down in my office, I closed the door, and I said, I got to do something. And what I came up with, what would the monks do? Service and selflessness. Well, if I forget about my own problems and my own issues in the sales department, what would I do? And what I did is I called up all the heads of the other departments and I said, I'd like to meet with you in your office. I want to make careful that it's on their turf. You know, they were hesitant, but they said, okay. They were probably thinking, what's coming here? I walked into their office with an 8.5 by 11 notepad. And I sat down and they were very hostile. They thought this was my list of things that they were doing wrong or whatever. And I sat down, I just leaned over the table at each one of them and I said, I'm here to find out what sales can do to make your life easier. And for a second or two, they were just shocked. And then they saw I was serious, and they started telling me all the things that sales were doing that was really ticking them off.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them were legitimate. And when I was finished writing them all down, I said, thank you for your time. I didn't talk about my list. And so then when I finally finished doing all that, I pulled the whole sales department together. I had people under me and the directors under them and managers under them and all the sales people. I got everybody together, including the admins. And they were waiting for, okay, what did you do? What's our big club that you're going to give for us? And I said, hey, the first thing we have to do is get our own house in order. We have to set an example. And I really had to call in my persuasion because that wasn't what they wanted to hear either, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
But a little bit of carrot and stick got them to go wrong. We cleaned up our act. One by one, all these other departmental heads came to me and said, hey, how do we get on board? How can we help you now?
Because you didn't ask for anything.
Because I didn't ask for anything. And when I wrote about that, and then I said, do you think I was panic-stricken. I didn't know it was going to work out. I was hoping it was going to work out. But I didn't have any, and the long story short, within 3 months, we had quadrupled sales. The company was profitable. We were humming. And it led to all kinds of great things. And then I finally said at the end, I find that I ended up making more money than I could ever have dreamed I was making.
As I said, you attribute a lot of your insights to the time you spend and continue to spend, because you're about to go back with the Trappist monks of Mepkin Abbey in Monk's Corner, as well as to your time as protege to a man called Lewis Mobley, who's the founder of the IBM Executive Development Schools. Do their theories or business theories or philosophies complement each other?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, when I spent 14 years with the, going back and forth visiting with the monks, and I go as a monastic guest, which means I live and work with them as if I were a monk. I wear kind of a habit, and I live in the same dorms that they do. And little by little, I started asking some very fundamental questions. How do a bunch of, not even a bunch, 20 or 25, 70-year-old guys working only 4 hours a day in silence with no real management, let alone any sticks or carrots or anything like that, manage to have all these fantastically successful businesses that they run? And not alone the library and facilities and guest houses and all this other upkeep. They have thousands of acres down there. And so I began to study them. This wasn't the reason why I was there. I've been interested in spirituality all my life, and this is my real passion. So I started going in 1996 to the monks for those reasons. But, as a business person, I gradually started looking at these. What are the common denominators here? And it was helpful because Mobley had provided me with a lens. I met Mobley in 1979 when I was just a kid, and I was on a quest to just find, meet interesting people and learn. And Mobley ended up inviting me to live in his house with his family, and I met every day in his study and spent 4 hours a day as his protege and worked with him. But that was kind of the – so a lot of the exact same principles that Mobley was talking about that he used to create – to put IBM, which, if you look at the 50s and 60s and the early 70s, that one was an IBM – all the people he turned out of the IBM executive school were the guys who made IBM into the premier company in the world by a long shot. So I saw that all these – the principles he was talking about, I was never in IBM, were the exact same things that the monks were practicing. And the monks probably can't even spell the word economics, even they can probably spell every theological term.
They could spell it in Latin.
They spell it in Latin. So they were practicing it. And then when I started my own company, then I started putting the same things into practice in my company with equally successful results.
So which is the bigger influence, the monks or Mr. Mobley?
Well, I think the monks are by far a far bigger influence on me. Well, first, for two reasons. One, I was only in my mid-20s when I met Mobley, and I live with him. He's been deceased for a number of years now, but I just saw his wife, and I still call her Mom. And so I don't want to minimize at all the incredible importance. But when you live around people and you're actually out there picking eggs and packing eggs and shipping them off to the grocery store and you're going on deliveries and,
Which is what the monks do.
Well, Mobley said, and let me tell you exactly what I mean by this. Mobley said that the difference between a leader and a manager is that leaders must decide the things worth doing in the first place. Managers get things done. And he said that leadership and executive leadership especially is not a question of skills and knowledge. It's a question of values and attitudes. And then he said he almost failed at the IBM executive school because it took him a long time to figure that out. And they tried to teach leadership through skills and knowledge. And then he's had to think of how do you change values and attitudes? And so he came up with a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. First of all, the most important way you can change people, because what I'm getting at, when I'm talking about conscious capitalism, I'm not talking about knowledge. I'm not talking about changing people's minds. When I work with salespeople and I talk about how it's in their own self-interest to forget their self-interest, they nod their heads off. Changing their minds is not that hard. Changing their behavior is extraordinarily hard. They walk right out of the room and start worrying about their commission plan. I call that a change of heart. And so Mobley was into a change of heart to be, he said, he used to say that going from a middle man, from a supervisor to a middle manager was incremental, was a step of education. Mm-hmm. Going from a middle manager to an executive was a revolution in consciousness. It was a complete change. And the monks practiced that exact same thing. So I call that a change of heart. How do you change people's hearts? And Mobley had a hierarchy of how you do that. The number one thing is experience itself is what changes people's values and attitudes, or what I'm calling a change of heart. Second best thing for that is games, simulations, experiential learning techniques. After that is all the other stuff. And for lecturing, reading, writing, arithmetic, all those things are almost ineffectual at doing it. Mm-hmm. What you think about in terms of all the things we've tried to do and try to change racial things. We lecture at people all the time. Mobley's research at IBM showed you don't change people's hearts by lecturing at them.
We're going to get into some of the nuts and bolts of what you call conscious capitalism in a little while here. But if you were the king of the best of all possible worlds and you were able to get the attention of business in America and they were to go through this transformation, what would it take? What would it look like? How difficult would it be to accomplish some of the things we're going to talk about here?
Well, it's going to be very, very difficult. But to me, it's not going to be any more difficult than the transitions we've seen before from, capitalism for all its quote unquote selfishness. Adam Smith was only half right, I say, and that's the piece he missed is he assumes that people are innately selfish. What the monks understand is, yes, people start selfish, but they can be transformed into being less selfish, mm-hmm. or even unselfish. But capitalism, as selfish as it may seem or be, is less selfish than mercantilism. Mercantilism is less selfish than feudalism, and feudalism is less selfish than us running around beating each other over the head and stealing each other's food. So we are on this halting, but these are huge steps going from mercantilism. It's the same thing as going from mercantilism to capitalism. And so how long do the, of course we have a lot more information. We have the internet. We have a lot more ways of disseminating. So I don't think change takes as long. Mm-hmm. But no, it's not going to be trivial. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly what my mission in life is. I don't know if I'll become king of the world over it, but I call it, developing transfer. And we can talk about this, but it's transformational organ. How do we do this now? That's the right. What now, what's the how? It's called what I call creating a transformational organization.
Well, you have said that you've described yourself as someone with a lifelong passion for personal transformation.
Right.
I'm not sure from what to what, but that's not important. It seems to me that you have to know or have to want to transform for this process to begin.
Exactly. And so, what I'm trying to do is, yes, I want to appeal to your better angels, mm-hmm. but I think that I call that exhortation. I think too much of what we do in terms of education is strictly exhortation. Well, you should do it. It's going to be, be a nice person. It's called what I call the Rodney King philosophy. Why don't we just all learn to get along and mm-hmm. be adults here? No, I'm saying that it's in your self-interest to forget your self-interest. You're going to be more successful.
We have to take a break. We're coming right back with August Turek, talking about conscious capitalism and transforming what we are today into something better. Charlotte Talks on WFAU. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the Southern Ideal Home Show, August 27th through 29th at the Park Expo and Conference Center, featuring experts in kitchen and bath design, building and home improvement. Details at southernidealhomeshow.com. In February of this year, a man who had served behind bars was exonerated when it was revealed that the State Bureau of Investigation's crime lab withheld evidence in his case. And what has followed has been revelation after revelation of procedures that violate both widely accepted standards and possibly the law. It's a very complicated story. We're going to go through it with the lead reporter on this story for the Raleigh News and Observer and others, Monday morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Alaska's GOP Senate primary race remains too close to call. New concerns about the strength of the economic recovery and New Orleans 5 years after Katrina.
It's the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with August Turak, who is a corporate executive and entrepreneur who has adopted a lot of the principles that he learned at the feet of Trappist monks in Monk's Corner, South Carolina. You can find more information about what we're talking about on his website, augustturak.com. You say that one of the things that the monks do well is they have an ability to take ordinary people and inspire them to achieve extraordinary things.
Right.
Among their own, the people in the abbey themselves or outside?
That's not just, first of all, it starts with the people who are the actual monks or people. Then you go down to the next tier and people like me who come down there and work their tails off. And feel grateful and privileged for the opportunity to work with them. The second kinds of people are all the people, their customers, the people that they get the same kind of support from the vendors and the grocery stores who sell their eggs and sell their products. They've got all kinds of volunteers who come and help them out. So they've got a whole infrastructure. It's what I would call stakeholders and stockholders, stockholders being the monks, and the stakeholders being the kinds of people that interact with them. They get that same kind of passion. And by the way, that's exactly another thing where Mobley and the monks come together, because Mobley used to say that the challenge of management is to build extraordinary organizations out of ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And how do we do that? And that was his big challenge.
Maybe this comes from my personal experience, but I know, you know, when you look at young people coming into an organization, a lot of them come in really thrilled to be there, wanting to be there with a passion for what they're going to learn and the fact that they're there. They have a passion for the industry that they're in. And you watch them mature over the years, and that passion begins to diminish.
Right.
And it's, I think, begun to diminish because it's beaten out of them by the system. How do we change that?
Well, I think that it's first of all recognizing what people want, and it may seem like a digression, but going back to what you said before about personal transformation and organizational transformation, I don't think there's anything really different to them. Even a corporation is considered by the law to be a person,
right,
for legal terms. And if you think about managing yourself versus managing an organization, managing yourself is just as hard as managing an organization because you have a million appetites in your head that are all competing for – you have to manage all that. So let's define what we mean by transformation. What I mean by transformation is a transformation from selfishness to selflessness. You know, every religion in the world, every mythology – Joseph Campbell taught this with the hero's journey – is a journey from selfishness to selflessness. That's what the hero goes through. All of these movies, the Groundhog Day, and all these movies coming out of Devil Wears Prada, I could go on and on, The Matrix, all of them are based on Campbell's model. Every story, we love stories, we spend billions of dollars every year to watch stories. Mm-hmm. What is Story 101? The main character must be transformed over the arc of it. We cannot have the same protagonist at the end of the story as we had at the beginning.
Right.
He has to be changed in a fundamental way. That doesn't mean his hairstyle is different at the end. It means he's changed. And in every uplifting story, the person is less selfish than they were.
Right. And isn't that the story of humanity?
I mean, that's the story of humanity. So I take it back and I say, listen, I'm an old marketing guy. I don't listen to what people say. I listen to what people do, and I especially listen to what they spend their money on. Mm-hmm. And when they're spending their money on stories and movies and everything, that are based on Joseph Campbell's model of the hero's journey to selflessness, I'm saying to myself, that's what they really want.
Yeah.
The problem is they vicariously don't actually go through experience it. So I said, We watch Truman escape from the Truman Show. We don't work on escaping from our own Truman Show. So what do we really want? We want transformation, but there's three kinds of transformation. When a thirsty man drinks, he transforms his condition. When a poor man hits the lottery, he transforms his circumstances. But when Mr. Scrooge wakes up on Christmas morning, an utterly new man, He has experienced a transformation of being. This is what the hero's journey is about. Now, organizations like the Marine Corps, Alcoholics Anonymous, IBM under Lou Mobley, many entrepreneurial companies that I could talk to you about. I knew Microsoft in the early days, did a lot of business with them, saw those kids underneath, sleeping underneath their desks. Asked him one time, I said, well, why do you guys do that? He said, well, let me tell you what it's all about at Microsoft. It's all about goat rodeos. And I said, what the heck's a goat rodeo? He said, well, I'll tell you what a goat rodeo is. He says, a goat rodeo is when Bill Gates calls you up and says he's going to be in Tokyo making a presentation 8 a.m., you know, a Monday morning, and he wants to demo your product, and it's only about half done, and it's Saturday. And somehow or another, you pull it together, and you get him everything he needs, all the bits and all that stuff, and he blows them away in Tokyo. That's one goat rodeo, man. And when you've done three or four goat rodeos, you've made your bones at Microsoft. Hmm. And this kid was radiating passion and heat and light.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, I've coined a word for this, that a lot of entrepreneurial companies, Mobley, Microsoft during that era, the AA, the Marine Corps, and the monks are transformational organizations. What do transformational organizations have all in common? Well, there's conscious and unconscious. I would say Microsoft was an unconscious, but let's take conscious ones, the monks or the Marine Corps. First of all, they have a high overarching mission, worthy of selflessly being served, whether it's defending the country or, you know, helping other people stay off alcohol by being an AA or serving God and serving other people like the monks. Second, though, what every one of these organizations has is a transformational technique, 12-step program, boot camp, IBM Executive School, the novitiate at the monastery.
Mm-hmm.
They have a process that people go through to bring about to match the mission to the behavior, so the change of heart takes place, not just the change of mind. When you decide to become a Marine or you decide to go to a monastery, your mind has been changed. But that doesn't mean your heart has been changed. And they understand that. And so they go through that. Now, in a lot of small organizations, I was just working with one last spring. The president walked me out, and he had like 75 of these young kids on the telephones working in sales and everything. The company's growing like crazy. He's only 26 himself. And he said, look at these kids. He said, they don't care about money. They don't care about the stock option plan and everything. And I didn't want to get into it right at that moment, but I'm thinking, yeah, I understand. They want to be transformed. They want to be different people from this experience. And that's why they're so passionate right now. And if you know, I'm thinking in my back of my mind, if I want to really help you as a consultant to you, then we got to make sure that we put things in place that doesn't abuse them, like you said.
And when I said a few minutes ago that it's the human experience, we begin as children, and it's all about me, me, me. It's all about self-identity. This is what I want. Gimme, 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 gimme,
right.
Gimme. And I guess when you become a parent, it's something about somebody other than you.
Right.
It's about taking care of your child.
Right.
However, we live in this me society. At least America is portrayed to be this selfish me society. Do you think?
By and large, it is.
Okay. So if we yearn for transformation, if we yearn to be part of something bigger than ourselves, if we yearn to be something different from what we are, why are we stuck in the me?
Well, let's go back to Socrates. Socrates said that all evil comes from ignorance. It's because we haven't thought it through enough. It's the same reasons why we eat too much or drink too much, when we know darn right well intellectually that it's not any good for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm trying to do. The first step is I have to get your attention and tell you what you really want, whether you like it or whether you agree with me or not. I know what you really want, and I can prove this to you not only with these movies and everything that I'm talking about, but the second thing that I want to point out is that we are happiest when we are lost in thought, when we are lost in a task, when we've lost ourselves. We're constantly trying to lose ourselves. As a matter of fact, the symptom, so it's not really selfishness we want, it's selflessness we want. We're trying to, self-consciousness on the other hand is, so when we're spontaneous and we're selfless and we're lost in thought and we've forgotten ourselves, we're happy.
Mm-hmm.
When we're sitting in a doctor's office wrapping our fingers on the table because we're completely self-conscious, we're unhappy, we're bored. The worst part of depression is you can't think of anything you can get lost in. Nothing makes, you know, you're constantly, it's an overwhelming sense of self. The word self-conscious, for example, is associated with all negative things.
Right.
So these kinds of things are telling me it's a mistaken belief that, and the reason for this is because there are transformations of condition when we're thirsty, drinking, transformations of circumstances like getting a bigger house when you have a bigger family are not bad. They're necessary. And so what we have done, though, is we have tried to substitute these kinds of transformations for the transformation of being. I think when somebody overeats in order to fill the soul hole with food and comfort food, they are trying to accomplish a transformation of being with a transformation of condition. When somebody tries to get famous, they're really hoping deep down inside that if they could change everyone's opinion of me, I'll change. I'll be a different person. The reason I believe why so many celebrities self-destruct is because deep inside they know they haven't changed. They feel guilty about that. Number two, it takes an enormous amount of psychic energy to keep the game going that I'm different from you and I'm better than you and I'm a celebrity. And so a lot of them end up, you know, just drained, and they need to use drugs and all that stuff. So drugs, alcohol, all these things are substituting a transformation of condition or circumstance. So it's natural because we do start out as animals. We do, the first thing a baby wants is to suck milk, and me. So the transformation is not a natural, it's natural to us, but it's not a natural step. I like to liken it to a child will learn to talk naturally. You can't stop a child from learning to talk. A child has a predisposition to learn and read and write, but unless you work on it, the kid will never learn to read and write. So it's not natural, completely natural and spontaneous. I think this whole transformation of being, and I think it's a lot of it has to do with our history. Only now are we, frankly, I don't want to call it rich enough, but we've taken care of conditioning.
Right.
And circumstances enough that this longing for a transformation of being is becoming much more widespread.
Well, even in this economic downturn, we still live in the richest society the world has ever known, and we're complaining about how bad things are, and things are bad. Do you see this then as an opportunity? Is this a good time to incorporate what we're talking about to bring us out of the economic doldrums?
Well, you know, my mother used to say that used to regale me with tales of the Depression, and a lot of them were very, very terrible stories, obviously. My parents, she came from a family of 10, and, you know, enough said. They went through very, very hard times. But my mother also used to say that it was an amazingly good time because people pulled together and people rethought their values and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's up to us to decide what we're going to take out of, like any kind of suffering, like any kind of crisis. Are you going to make it a learning experience and take what you can? I want to come back to your point, though, because I don't think this is pie in the sky. Warren Buffett is one of my heroes. And I read his biography recently. He's an agnostic, so he's not a monk. But the fact of the matter is that he consistently buys companies that would go on the open market for $1 billion for $800 million. Why? You know, instead of there being a premium, there's a Buffett premium to his stock, but there's also a Buffett discount to his purchases because the people know that he is ethical, that he's a good guy, that he's not going to stab you in the back, and they would rather sell their company to him for $800 million than sell it to a bunch of sharks at $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I read his biography, it said that the woman who wrote this said the big secret that nobody knows, that Buffett knows, is he says he owes all of his success not to a business school or even to Ben Graham, his mentor, but to Dale Carnegie, and how he took Dale Carnegie's principles and put them to practice and worked on himself to transform himself as a young man, and continues to do it to this day. So his reputation for ethics, his reputation for honesty is priceless and has become an enormous lubricant in his business career and has made him so wealthy. Now he's got so much prestige that, you know, he's able to guide people like Bill Gates, and they're putting in all these billionaires that just came out a couple of weeks ago and say they're going to put their money into charity and things like that. Mm-hmm. People trust Warren Buffett. The government trusts him, and it makes his life 90,000 times easier than
we had.
So he's a counterexample to what you're talking about.
We had a former daughter-in-law of his on the program several years ago, and she had written a book about him, and it wasn't an uncomplimentary book, but she mentioned that he lives. If you walked into his house, you would never know that he was a multi-billionaire.
Hey, he's been famous
for
that all his life.
Yeah, frugally, all to the point where his wife had to threaten him to replace the threadbare carpet in the living room.
Right.
Now, is that being selfless, or is that just being stingy?
everything I've ever, and I've been a follower of his since 1979, and I read everything, I don't think he's stingy.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly he's not stingy if he's giving all of his wealth to charity. I think it is part of being selfless.
Mm-hmm.
He is aiming at he has a higher goal and a higher mission, and a lot of this kinds of stuff that bogs us down in day-to-day routines and things like that don't affect him so much. The same thing with the monks. I mean, Father Christian down at the monastery, he's got three PhDs. He's my spiritual director. He's 93 years old now. I try to do things for him. He likes root beer. I heard out through the grapevine he likes root beer. I bought some premium root beer. I brought a lousy six pack of premium root beer last time I was at the monastery and gave it to him. That man has saved my life. You know, a few minutes later I see that it's in the kitchen, so that anybody can have one. This is not something that he is persecuting himself for. It's a habit. I mentioned in that article that the first time I was ever at the monastery, I was standing in line waiting for the food, and there was this 88-year-old guy in front of me, a monk, and the trays were stacked under the table, and he starts to bend over to get this, a tray, and it takes forever to get a tray because he's 88 years old. And I notice deep inside that I'm getting a little bit annoyed, like, can you pick it up a little bit? He finally picks up the tray, and when he gets the tray, he turns around with an angelic smile, and he hands it to me. And I said, there's something magical about that place. I said, I couldn't help myself. I kept coming back, and the next thing you know, I'm giving away trays as fast as I possibly can. When you build a culture, they've built a culture of it. It's unconscious. I won $100,000 for my essay, Brother John, in the Templeton Foundation's contest, about Brother John standing outside in the rain on Christmas Eve under an umbrella just in case somebody had forgotten theirs so he could walk them back to their room. I just saw Brother John recently at his 50th anniversary as a monk. And I walked up, and he's a very shy guy, hardly ever says anything. And I said to him, Brother John, I'm going to ask you. And he said, what? Do you remember standing outside under the rain for me? He looked at me and grinned, and he said, do you remember every time you ever answered the phone?
So it's just ordinary stuff.
And this is what it becomes second nature. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to have this same kind of thing, if you want to be a great salesman, you want to be great in marketing, then thinking about the customer has to be second nature. It has to be not something, I'm going to sit down now and think about the customer because I want to come up with a good marketing campaign. No, it's got to be your habitual way. I was thinking on the way coming in here today that when we sold our company to the Israeli company, we caused a nightmare because we suddenly announced all the investment bankers and all the army of accountants and everything that we're going to give 5% of the company to our employees. We had no stock plan. We had no obligation of any type to give this thing away. And I won't get into the details, but it really did throw a monkey wrench into the closing and everything. One reason being that if we give them a lot of stock and there's no public market for the stock, they're going to have to pay taxes on stock that they can't sell. They said, you mean to tell me that you don't have any obligation to do this? And if we don't get this closed by March 31st, the world's coming to an end. Forget about it. They don't even know about it. No, we insisted on it. And they finally, and put the people to work and the expense to be able to do it. We changed all the stock into options for them and things like that. And 3 or 6 months later, I was in Israel, and one of the guys that was involved walked up and said, what'd you get out of that? I said, I don't know, but I'd do it again.
Wow. August Turak is our guest. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the secrets the Trappists have that we can apply both in our personal lives, I guess, and also in our capitalistic endeavors. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by Mary Poppins, Broadway's hit musical from Disney and Cameron McIntosh. Performances through September 19th in the Belk Theater. Tickets are available at 704-372-1000. Coming up in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the first hour of the two-hour weekly news roundup, the international hour at 11. At 10 o'clock hour, they'll talk about national stories, including Alaska's GOP Senate primary race remaining too close to call, and new concerns about the strength of the economic recovery, along with New Orleans, a look back 5 years after Katrina. That's coming up in just a few minutes here on WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation, jump in, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Students are back at school, and business is picking up. Don't get left behind. Support WFAE programming and reach the Charlotte region's best and brightest audience with your message. Find out how to promote your company on WFAE by emailing underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting in our Spirit Square studio today with August Turak, a corporate executive, and we're talking about conscious capitalism and bringing service and selflessness into the equation, something he learned at the feet of Trappist monks at Mepkin Abbey in Monk's Corner. Aside from service and selflessness, which is hard to say,
I better change it then.
That's right, and is a commitment to excellence.
Right.
A ruthless dedication to the highest ethical standards, faith, trust, and living the life. Right. Let's talk about those things. I would think most people have a commitment to excellence, or am I wrong?
No, I don't think that most people do have everybody, again, intellectually likes the idea of a commitment to excellence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've worked in many companies where the old saying, good enough for government work, or
right,
or what I don't get done today, I'll get to tomorrow, and all that kind of stuff, is prevalent. And sometimes it's actually passive aggressive. You know, they're treating me like, they're lucky they get what they get out of me, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So actually harnessing the innate human drive, for excellence for the sake of excellence.
Mm-hmm.
I remember T.S. Eliot defining spirituality itself as a one long purification of motive. And to me, one of the hardest things to get to is the selflessness, because we all know when we think about it that science for science's sake is the most productive science that you can do. Art for art's sake is the most productive art you can do. Truth for the truth's sake is the most productive philosophy you can do. But getting to that point, so this was Aristotle's point of view, and this is where it's hooked into the idea of living the life, because Aristotle said, we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not a choice, it's a habit. Getting back to our previous segment, the excellence of the monks is a habit that they've built in. They don't realize how many times they've picked up the phone any more than we do.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is instilled in them and encouraged, and it's the same thing. I find that when I'm down there, I don't take shortcuts that I would ordinarily take in almost any other area of my life when I'm with those guys.
Ruthless dedication to the highest ethical standards. If we want to be transformed, why does that seem to be difficult for some people to engage in?
Because when the pressure comes down, it's one thing for us to have, and we get scared. It's very, very frightening when we have to make a choice between recalling a product that may put the company out of business and coming out with it. The monks will never hesitate in that kind of thing, because they are committed to a higher ideal. I'm working with the Environmental Protection Agency, and one of the people there told me privately that after listening to some of the talks that I gave, he decided that he needed to center his life around his family and improve his family relationships. And after he had done that and centered himself and his family, he said making the right choices at his job became much more easy, because that wasn't where he was centered. Too many of us are centered in our business card. You take my business card away from me, I don't exist anymore. The monks aren't centered in their business card. They're not centered in their business.
Right.
So they're much more likely that when the heat comes down to do the right thing. And what we all need is to be centered in something deeper than.
Well, that leads us to the word faith in right. What they dedicate themselves to. And that's easy to understand in a religious context, and they are a religious organization. How do you bring that into a secular setting?
Well, you know, first of all, I redefine faith even in their context, because I've actually found that as I've gotten to know a lot of the monks, that their religious beliefs are very diverse, actually. Some of them might actually get them in trouble with the Catholic Church if they were actually. But what they share is, I distinguish between belief and faith. And I'm not minimizing belief or theological beliefs or any kind of beliefs that you might have. Faith, though, to me is an action thing. Faith is what keeps you going when it doesn't seem to make sense anymore. Faith is what gets you to give 5% of your company away when you don't really see what particular benefit that's ever going to bring back to you. So these are the kinds of behaviors that you do when the future looks opaque, when the future looks dark, and you don't really understand how this is all going to turn out in the end, you do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I talk about my own life. One of the great challenges of my life was when I started working with college students in 1988. I volunteered to work with a group of college students who were interested in these issues, and there was only four or five of them. No sooner did I do that than I got the job opportunity of a lifetime if I would move. I turned the job down to work with the five college students on a volunteer basis. This took, it was not easy. Believe me, it was a dream job with United Press International, as a matter of fact. But everything that I can look back now and see that if UPI eventually went bankrupt again, I started a company instead. I'm the one that came out ahead. Everybody that took that, played the sure thing, didn't. Mm-hmm. So I don't care whether you're religious or not, or Christian or not. I like the quote from Jesus, though. Seek first the kingdom of heaven and everything else will take care of itself. What is your quote-unquote heaven in your life? What is that big thing that you're all about? And if you have that thing and you really seek that first and put that as a priority in your life, everything will take care of itself.
So what then is the difference between faith and the next thing on the list, trust?
Well, faith engenders trust. When I talked about, I had to have faith at that case study that we talked about earlier, to go to these people and get my house in order in sales. I call that being a corporate statesman. Trying to put the interests of everybody in front of my interest in sales. And I had to have the faith to do that it would work out. Mm-hmm. The result was the trust I engendered because I was sincere. When they finally looked at it long enough to figure this wasn't some ploy and it wasn't something that I was going to figure, then I got trust. Once I got trust, I got power. Because they all came to me and said, "How can I help? How can I help? How can I help?" And the president even came to me and said, "Sales is rapidly becoming the point of the spear. We all want to help sales." So I, without having a position, without having a title, without anything like that, I had all the influence I could possibly want to achieve my goals, which were the company's goals, to quadruple sales. And then all of a sudden, when I open my paycheck is quadruple.
And then living the life. Is that just simply walking the talk?
Exactly. This is what is missing. This is why people are so frustrated in corporations, because the mission is all mom and apple pie. The corporate mission statement is all mom and apple pie, and nobody follows it through. In that article for Forbes, I said, it's not a question of how can you have a more lofty mission than serve God and serve mankind and the monks? It's not the fact that it's too lofty and it's too abstract or it's not specific enough. No, it's that we don't have the discipline and we don't have the willingness as executives to make all the tiny connections that allows the person in the mailroom to see how they're hooking into this mission, as the monks do.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of phone calls from folks who want to contribute here or ask questions, and we'll begin in Wake Forest with Chris. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I was wondering if maybe August could share some more thoughts with us on this concept of, you talked a little bit about faith and religion, and sometimes in the workplace that can be difficult to sort of introduce. So if you could maybe share some ideas when you're talking with business folks about how you begin to introduce the concept of, working with a focus on a higher purpose and sort of stay away from some of the difficulties when you start talking about religion.
Absolutely. That's an absolutely great question. I've been giving a bunch of talks recently, especially to the American Marketing Association. And what I start by saying is that Megatrends 2010, the bestseller, and there's a host of books. They're becoming a chorus of people saying the spirituality is going to be the mega trend of the 21st century. Okay, that and 50 cents or a buck will get you a cup of coffee. So what are we going to do with that? Well, the first thing that I have to say is we can't go religious. That's just not going to work. The second thing we have to ask ourselves is this true or is this just something these guys are hyping up in these books? I say it's true because, as I mentioned previously, when you look at all these movies, The Matrix and Truman Show and all these, they're all based on the transformational model of Joseph Campbell. And everybody knows that there's a spiritual element to The Matrix. and or they feel it or they know it intellectually if they study think about it for a second.
And Star Wars is another one.
They've become Groundhog Day. I mean, Devil Wears Prada. Either. I got a lot of fun in New York last year because I was telling all my friends that I thought Devil Wears Prada was one of the most spiritual movies I ever saw. So the fact of the matter is that the religious right, the far religious right, attacks these movies. There's another way in which you're being, that you're being justified. They see the spirituality there. Mm-hmm. So what I've done is I'm saying, hey, let's not talk about spirituality or religion or anything. Let's talk about this transformational model. Let's talk about what transformation is. Let's talk about, let's equate it just as easily with Mr. Scrooge waking up on Christmas morning and utterly changed man. It can't be religious. It can be as religious as the Buddha, as enlightenment, or it can be as not every day. I wish it was every day that Mr. Scrooge would people would have changes of heart like Mr. Scrooge, but as understandable as a lot of these movies are making it. So if you want to look at that whole transformational model, the hero's journey that Campbell is talking about, how can we then redefine that down into a more simple process? It's a transformation from selfishness to selflessness. And this agrees with, I don't care whether it's Plato, whether it's mythology, whether it's story, whether it's Buddhism, Christianity, take your pick. This is a common denominator for all of this stuff. So what I'm saying is, let's not get into religion. Let's talk about a transformation from selflessness to selfishness to selflessness.
Chris, thank you for your call. Let's go to Wadesboro. Debbie, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Oh, welcome. I am so glad to be talking to you about this. I've been thinking about this and working about this and praying about this, that we need real transformation for everybody. I belong to some 12-step programs. I want to condense this. I think this will be what saves the planet, if you will. But let's keep it simple. There's a 12-step program, and it's basically trust the higher power. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the God of a church. It can just be a group of people, because I'm one power and there's two and three and four and so on, or business people like Warren Buffett and others, trust the higher power, clean house. See, that's the problem, I think, with most people is they don't want to clean their own house. They don't want to take responsibility for their own behavior and their own situation. Clean my house and then share with others. So now you've covered the steps. And then we have the traditions, which are self-supporting through our own contributions. Common welfare should come first, and so on. So you can go through all those. They're wonderful. What I think we need is a program. And I was going to write to Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and copy Bill Gates. I've already called Warren Buffett's office. I've talked to his secretary. He's very quick. And I want a business model. I'd like to see a business model. Instead of giving your money to charity, why don't you take 10% and tithe it and help get people, teach them to fish instead of buying them fishing.
All right.
How's that sound?
Get comment?
Oh, well, first of all, I couldn't agree more that, in a spirit of full disclosure, I'm not a drinker, so I've never actually been in a 12-step program or drugs or anything like that. But I have been an admirer from afar for many, 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 many years because I've met so many people who have come through those programs who are utterly transformed. And I like to point out to people that in my studies, the purpose of most people think the mission or goal of Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, is to get people off alcohol. I disagree with that. I say that the mission is to go through a radical transformation so that the byproduct is that you no longer use alcohol. And the reason I say that is in many programs they say that you can be a dry drunk. A dry drunk is someone who doesn't drink technically, but they have not had the transformation, and they're the ones that are going to slip back into it. So I couldn't agree more. Sometimes I've actually said that if I had a magic wand, I would have everybody in the world go through a 12-step program.
Debbie, thank you for your call. Alden in Charlotte writes, yesterday I was fortunate to attend an online seminar with Stephen Covey where he discussed the importance of smart trust in business. Smart trust involves communicating expectations and holding people accountable rather than just letting them do whatever they want, but giving employees the permission to use their own judgment to create good outcomes for their companies. This philosophy seems to dovetail nicely with that of your guest, and I'm wondering what he thinks of Covey's principles concerning trust and employee engagement.
Well, I'm a big fan of Stephen Covey's. I would go a little bit further, and everything that was said there I would agree with. What I'm always telling people in business when I'm working with them, whatever, let's go back to parenting. Whatever you want, Lou Mobley used to say, employees respect what managers inspect. I say that employees model the behavior they see in their leadership. Mm-hmm. If you want trust, you have to extend it first. Going back again to my case study about turning that company around, I wanted trust, but I had to go and stick my neck out a mile with all these other department heads in order to get it. I had to go first. I call this just going first. You have to go first. You have to be accountable before you ask for accountability. All those kinds of things are, you know, it's as simple as military history back to the beginning of man. Lead from the front. And so don't expect your kids to do things, not do things, you know, do as I say, not as I do. No, that doesn't work. So I think that the other thing that I think that that intrigues me, and I've read a lot of Covey's work, is that Covey, of course, says that we need passion, we need motivation. What I focus on with individuals is, where does passion and motivation come from? Because all the self-help books in the world will start on page one saying, none of this stuff that you're going to learn in this book is going to do you any good unless you do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I only have 30 seconds left. I got 1,000 questions left here. But if we all acted like the monks, wouldn't we be monks? And how can we take what they do and turn it into something that is, in fact, money-making? Because they are not profit-driven people.
Of course they're profit-driven people. They have to make more money than they spend at the end of the month or they don't eat. They just don't pay taxes on that profit.
Well, therein lies part of the world.
You know, but their businesses, I've been to their financial meetings. You know, you invest X and you have to get Y back. They're very, very profit and bottom line driven.
But business is a byproduct. It's not the
business
end all
is
be
the
all.
Byproduct. Exactly. And that's the reason why the model works, whether you're a monk or not.
And it can work in the outside world?
Absolutely. Somebody said to me one time, well, they have volunteer help down there. I said, well, why don't you have volunteer help? Why don't you inspire interns and people to come work for you?
August Turek has been our guest. You can find out more about what we're talking about at augustturek.com. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.